which most of the time will be featuring excerpts from morning shows that have been broadcast that previous week. On today's program, you'll hear, among other things, an excerpt from an interview I was privileged to record with NPR's Scott Simon. You'll also be hearing today from one of WGTD's most frequent guests, Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College. But we begin with an excerpt from an interview that I was privileged to record with an NBA legend, Ray Scott, who played in the 1960s and then went on to coach for several years in the NBA, actually as the first black coach to be named NBA Coach of the Year. He has written a wonderful memoir about his intriguing life and career called The NBA in Black and White, the memoir of a trailblazing NBA player and coach, the book published by Seven Stories Press. I want to make sure that we take a moment to mention a couple of elements to who you are and what was important to you, even as you are rising in the ranks as a talented young basketball player who eventually makes his way all the way to the NBA. Although basketball was in so many ways at the heart and soul of your story and of what was important to you, you are also somebody who really loves music, and we see that reference again and again and again to the musicians and entertainers that you got to encounter, and you also have been for a long, long time a lover of books. At one point in the book, you say how much you loved reading the works of James Baldwin, Richard Wright, Alex Haley, Malcolm X, Ernest Hemingway, Langston Hughes. You talk about how reading was something that helped to center you and helped you actually become a better player, not just a better person. What was it about this particular facet of your life, your devotion to reading, that you think helped make you a better basketball player?
Oh, man. I think where reading helped me as a basketball player was that it brought a calm, and it brought an interest, and it brought an exploration of words, which helped me in dialogue with teammates. I had something to talk about. I had questions about how their development or who they read. I think one of the pictures, you know, because our lives are made up of snapshots, and one of the snapshots I have is I was getting on the plane one day as a Detroit Piston. I was a young Detroit Piston, so that's like '60s, and we had just drafted a kid out of Indiana by the name of Tom Van Arsdale, who was a twin. He had a twin brother. And Dickie played in with the Knicks in New York, and Tommy played with us in Detroit. And so I nicknamed him Tubby. I don't know why, but I loved the name Tubby. He was just a great guy. And I'm getting on the plane one day, and I'm thinking, I'm reading something. I want to say something by Hemingway, because I really read everything by Hemingway, because I saw a movie called A Farewell to Arms, and I fell in love with Rock Hudson and Jennifer Jones, and I just thought that was one of the greatest movies I've ever seen in my life, and to this day I still think that. But anyway, that's an aside. As I'm getting on the plane back to Van Arsdale, and I'm walking down the aisle, Van Arsdale's reading a book. Well, that caught me, because I love to sit. That's what I did. I sat on the plane and I read books and stuff like that. And I said, "Tubby, what are you reading?" And he had this big, thick book. And he said, "I'm reading The Brothers Karamazov." And I said, "That's one of the deepest books on the planet, The Brothers Karamazov." And Tubby was reading this book, and I just remembered that picture of him. And it was long-lasting. And so when it came time for me to get the guys to do blurbs for my book, honest to goodness, the name that came to mind, because I remembered that in Tommy Van Arsdale, I said, "I want Tommy Van Arsdale to read my book." And I sent it to Tommy to read. And but we were good friends to this day. We've talked in this period, and I just I just remembered that. That was my attraction or my thought in books. It just that lasted with me. That snapshot of Tommy reading the Brothers Karamazov, that lasted with me all of my life. And I remember talking with Eddie Miles, the man with the golden arm. He played with me in the 60s, and I would sit and talk with Eddie, and we would talk about James Baldwin and Richard Wright, because Richard Wright, a lot of his writings was about, began in the Deep South. His settings were for writing his books, kids coming to Chicago or New York, and they came from the Deep South. And so Eddie and I used to sit and talk about that. And I talked with Dave DeBuscher. Dave became our coach. And Dave would talk to me. He would ask me about Hemingway's books. And Dave was another guy. He was a reader. And when Dave was 24 years old and the head coach of the Detroit Pistons, and this is back again in mid-60s, Dave was made the head coach at 24 years of age. But I think part of it was because Dave read, and he would be sitting in the locker room reading the Wall Street Journal. 24 years old, he's studying the journal, and giving us stock tips.
Amazing.
And so people that read just always intrigued me, because that piece on words and exploration in your mind. I don't know. I thought it made you run plays better or something in basketball. But it seemed to give you a concentration that you should have to be involved in basketball. So ultimately, and I studied not only books, but I studied basketball.
Hmm. So when you are drafted by the Detroit Pistons and your NBA career begins, the way I understand it from your book, you'd always thought of yourself primarily as a shooter. Yes, I mean, that is, scoring points was what you were all about, and you were really, really good at that. But you became part of a team in which there was already a lot of offensive fireworks in place. And so your role was ultimately going to change. In fact, you go so far as to say that that the Pistons wanted you in the rotation, but my job was to figure out what role I could play to help the team. I found that really interesting, because I think a lot of us who aren't part of this world at all would assume that that's somebody else's job to look at you and then decide, Ray Scott, I think you're going to be good at this. This is what we're going to use you at. But you felt like that was incumbent on you to kind of figure that out. Explain kind of what that was about. I mean, how does a player figure that out? And what did you ultimately discover was your destiny in terms of being a contributing player for the Pistons?
That was a good time for me to learn. I was looking at the game from that perspective that you spoke of, coming from the Eastern League, averaging 33 points a game, which means I'm getting a lot of shots. You know, I mean, the artillery is coming from a couple of guys, and I'm one of those guys. And I get to the Pistons, and they have Don Ohl, Gene Shue, and Bailey Howell. Two of the three of those guys are Hall of Famers. So they were, and the third guy, Don Ohl, oh my goodness, he was lights out. So I come, and he's a young guy. And so I come to the team, there's these three gentlemen, and I'm not going to get enough shots. I thought I was going to average maybe 20 points a game or something. And I'm not going to obviously get enough shots to do that. So now I'm kind of floundering. I'm trying to figure out, I'm thinking, I'm not reacting, I'm not playing, and the assistant coach, who happened to be Earl Lloyd, pulled me aside. And he said, Raymond, you're not getting it. We need you to play the way you can play, but figure out. We want you to be athletic. We want your athleticism. We want your ability to score when you can, but You're not primary. We need you to figure out what you can do to help this team. So, Greg, I go and I sit on the bench, and I sit at home, and I remember there was a game that was being played, and I was literally benched. I didn't play or played very little. And I went home, and I just sat down and said, okay, you got to figure this out. And I went position by position, and I said, the only way that I can get in this lineup is become a hard-nosed defensive player, which I was not because I was a finesse player, a hard-nosed defensive player, and rebound, get possessions for the team, get rebounds. And it was like a lot coming on. And I promise you, I went out and I played every game from that point on like I was a madman. And I wound up that year ninth. I think I was ninth in the league in rebounding. And I hadn't started the first quarter of the year. But I figured it out that that's what the team need with shooters. Because we've got three guys shooting the ball. Then you go get the ball, rebound the ball, get it back to those guys.
Ray Scott's book is titled The NBA in Black and White, The Memoir of a Trailblazing NBA Player and Coach, published by Seven Stories Press. You're listening to Morning Show Saturday here on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Now a brief excerpt from my most recent conversation with Dr. Art Sear from the faculty of Carthage College. Dr. Sear is by far the most frequent Morning Show guest with whom I've spoken over the last 20-plus years. We have to begin with, of course, the shocking events that unfolded in Highland Park on the 4th of July, when, of course, as all of our listeners know, a mass shooting occurred, half a dozen people killed and more injured. Just a stunning turn of events, and yet in other ways not surprising. I mean, given this escalating epidemic of gun violence across the country, but I think it's fair to say that there was something exceptionally shocking about it unfolding in a place like Highland Park, which, of course, is close to our listening area. And I think, I'm not sure exactly where you live down in Illinois, but is that relatively close to where you live?
Yes, very close to my family home.
Yeah. So I just wondered what your reaction was to that and what you see in terms of a way ahead in trying to deal with this epidemic of gun violence.
Well, I don't have any. I'm certainly not going to give you the easy, glib answers that dominate the public discussion now. It is a continuing problem in this country, among industrialized countries. We don't have, compared to Europe, Japan, other countries that have gone through the Industrial Revolution, we don't have a feudal tradition. We are not, by definition, a stable society. We also have pervasive violence in the media since the 60s, readily available to very young children, very violent and graphic video games of all kinds, readily available to anyone. We also have pervasive pornography, which is very, very destructive, especially for younger people. Young women as well as young men and boys and girls. I think that fact of life, which is never mentioned in major media in this country, is one factor among others. The first of these now unfortunately fairly common mass killings was in 1964. In modern times, a very troubled man by the name of Charles Whitman, a Marine Corps veteran who served his country honorably and who'd been going through some very serious trouble. He consulted no less than five doctors and psychiatrists in the year leading up to his terrible violent behavior. He climbed up to the top of a very tall tower at the University of Texas, and he was a very good shot, a very good marksman. He killed 14 people and wounded, I believe, more than 30 others before two heroic policemen plus an armed civilian managed to get up to the top of the tower and kill him. President Lyndon Johnson did not rush to the scene. That would have been considered gross behavior by that generation at that time. But he did immediately propose gun control legislation, which was reinforced by the terrible assassination of Robert Kennedy in 1968. And by 1968, it was a struggle even for the very talented LBJ legislatively, one of the greatest legislative achievers in this country's history, as Senate Majority Leader as well as President. He did get significant legislation through, and that's all to the good. And we should all be happy about the fact that the Senate was able to get together rather quickly on gun control legislation. But the problem isn't guns. We Americans like to look to the other, something tangible, something technological, ideally, because that's what we love so much. If we can do this tangible thing, we'll solve the problem. But the real problem is us and our society, in my view. Obviously, I'm not running for office. And I'm fortunate not to be looking for work at the moment. But that's why you're not going to hear this that much. But that's what I honestly believe.
Right.
And I like to think that I would be saying that in any case.
Right.
I hope that's clear.
I think you're being very clear. And I think it points to something that we don't hear very much in discussions, that this tends to be the kind of conversation where either you think the problem is guns or the problem is not guns. And I think what you're pointing to is a wise middle ground, which is that the problem is not just guns. I mean, the problem is not just easy access to guns, but the problem is also kind of a societal condition that is leading to more and more people that find themselves kind of in this emotional, agitated state of such anger or whatever it is that in which they lash out, and they're lashing out with weapons that can cause tremendous harm in a very short amount of time. But it's more than just one or the other, and there's not a simple solution, though we wish there was one. I think that's what you're saying, or am I shifting your focus?
No, not at all. There is a positive context, which is important to consider without in any way minimizing this latest tragedy or any others. Going back to Whitman in 1964, the long-term trend actually has been dramatic reduction in gun homicides as a proportion of the population in this country. We had an enormous, very violent crime wave, crimes of all kinds, which became visible at the end of the 50s and continued into the early 90s, then declined. There was a sudden rise. There was a peak in 1993. But in terms of available data, and it's reliable data, today in America, there was a steep decline from 1993 that has continued. It started to reverse in 2014, and it's unclear, but we're nowhere near the levels of that earlier crime wave. There are lots of explanations, and politicians on the right, Barry Goldwater notably, Ronald Reagan, his successor in terms of policy and themes. Reagan benefited enormously, as we all know, by emphasizing this understandable fear and tremendous problem of violent crime. We don't have that today in the mass, but we do have our lives punctuated by these occasional horrible incidents which have become all too regular.
Right. Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College is a monthly visitor to The Morning Show. To finish out this edition of Morning Show Saturday, here's an excerpt from my memorable Morning Show interview from 2010 with NPR Scott Simon, talking about his illuminating and deeply personal memoir called Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, In Praise of Adoption, in which he chronicles the experience he and his wife Carolyn had of adopting two beautiful baby girls from China. Your story of adoption actually has an interesting first chapter of sorts, a moment in the nation of Ethiopia. And I wonder if you would share with our listeners this very powerful moment and to what extent it resonates with what you and your wife ultimately decided to do.
Well, you know, I was in Ethiopia covering what was then the civil war and famine in that country. And we went to an orphanage. There were lots of youngsters who had been orphaned and or abandoned, really for a generation in Ethiopia. And they were all little boys in white shirts, and just called out something within me. I began to pick them up. I began to hoist them on my shoulders. I began to hold them. I began to kiss them. And these were little boys who had been surviving, living, you know, one of the a very good church-run orphanage. As my wife says, there are orphanages that they have enough resources. There's enough food for the youngsters. There's enough clothing. They might be warm enough, but there are no happy orphanages. And these are youngsters who had just been longing for a human touch, and I happened to be the human being who walked in that day and began to give it to them. And we just spent the day hugging and kissing and rolling around on the ground and holding them. And when I went to sleep that night, I literally felt an ache for their, you know, their little heads against my shoulders. And it was, I think, one of the first times I began to think that I really want to be a father. I really want to look out for someone in this world.
Hmm. As you and your wife realized your situation, before we get into that, because I find myself hesitating how to frame this question, yeah. It brings to mind the fact that you talk in the book about how some of the challenges involving language are really exquisitely
oh my gosh.
Difficult. You write, writing about adoption is fraught with opportunities for people to take offense. Can
yeah.
you just say a word about that? Because I suspect that weighed very heavily on you as you put
yeah,
words
I mean,
on the
it's,
screen.
It's absolutely a rhetorical minefield when you try and do it, because people do not like the phrase, for reasons I understand, his adopted child. So you have to say his child who is adopted. Even though I think the majority of people that encapsulate an observation like that certainly don't mean to be offensive. You have to use a phrase like has an adoption plan, which I think is I don't mind saying ludicrous when applied to a young woman in China, scared young mothers in China, who have to give up their children because they know they can't. No, they can't keep them under the law because of China's obnoxious state family planning policies and specifically the one-child policy. And without meaning to, you can say something that absolutely inflames people because a lot of them know the two or three phrases that most offend them, and so that's what they're kind of loaded with a baseball bat ready to swing out at. But when you're certainly writing a book that touches on adoption, you have to phrase different situations in maybe 100 different ways. So it's a minefield.
Right.
I mean, knock wood, so far it's been okay.
Good. And so far, I hope okay with our interview. The question I'm framing in my mind is something to the effect that when you and your wife
discovered that the traditional Abraham and Sarah begetting manner wasn't working.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Yes, yes, right, exactly.
When you knew that was appearing to not be a feasible option for you, and then you began to consider adoption, you shared with us some really interesting reasons why ultimately international adoption became your choice, and also why China ultimately was the most attractive option. Speak about both of those important choices that you and your wife made.
Yeah, and you know, I should explain that circumstances change, I think, from year to year. I certainly have heard, just since I've been making appearances with this book, from a lot of families who will fill in the blanks about why it can be daunting to adopt domestically. In our particular case, like Frank DeFord talks about in his case, I was already over 40. My wife is not yet there. And many domestic adoption authorities prefer to give preference to younger parents. So we would have been at the back of the line. And this creates things, which is not to say that maybe we wouldn't have had a child in our arms in 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years, but who could say? There was a anxiety about that. There are also other international programs. In fact, we looked at Ethiopia. That was the first program at which we looked. And the good news at that particular point for Ethiopia was that there weren't that many children that were available, so there was a long waiting list. Now, by the way, Ethiopia has a more active program than it did then. China had the most expeditious program going. They said that once you were approved, you could have a baby in your arms within 9 months. And given the fact that we had already spent 2 years trying to start a family, that sounded very good to us. Now, of course, China, altogether different. In fact, I'm doing this interview with you from Boulder, Colorado. I met a family last night at one of my appearances that said that they were approved. They got, I guess, what's called their authorization in 2006. So they have already been waiting for 4 years, and let's figure another year where they went through the paperwork. So they've been waiting for 5 years for a child from China. Now, had that been the case when my wife and I were adopting, we would not have adopted in the Chinese program. But at that particular point, it seemed the most expeditious. And, you know, you also look for signs. I'm not sure I can explain that. But you look for kind of the universe to arrange itself in such a way that a cloud will open and it will reveal your path to you. And in our case, my wife and I, who had a stunningly quick courtship, had fallen in love in Chinatown in New York. She had an apartment on Mott Street. And somehow that seemed to fit.
One of the things that is endearing about your story, and in some respects even encouraging, I suppose, is that your story of, particularly with your first daughter you adopted from China, is not exactly a story of love at first sight as far as she was concerned.
No, absolutely not. Goodness gracious. Well, we were put into her arms. The only world that she had known, she's 11 months old, of course, had been in that orphanage, in that institution. And we know it was cold. We know that she was fed according to a rigid schedule. We know that she was never held, kissed, all of that stuff that simply the numbers make it impossible to do in orphanages. But it was the only world that she knew, and she was understandably anxious. And suddenly there's these two big adults all over her, and were kissing her, and were holding her, and were cooing to her. Our little girl, Elise, talking about oldest daughter, her Chinese name is Feng Xiaomei, which is now her middle name. So we would kind of stand on either side of her, my wife and I, and try and to persuade her that we were on her side, and we would chant, Feng Xiaomei, Feng Xiaomei, Feng Xiaomei. And for 2.5 days, she cried. She cried inconsolably. She was crying so much, only pausing to come up for air so that she could eat. I really thought the little tears on her little face was turning so red and so hot. I thought the tears would kind of break into droplets of steam. And then, after 2.5 days, and not long after we gave her a bath, which she rather decided that she liked, I don't know. She just, as Steve Levitt, the Freakonomics professor, says in the book, children are not only, and she was 11 months at that point, remember, children are not only amazingly absorbent and remember things, they also have a genius for forgetting what they don't need to survive. And I think after 2.5 days, she had just determined that we were there, that we were her ticket in life, and we were the folks to whom she'd been given in the universe at this particular point, and we seemed to be doing okay by her, and so that was okay with her. And then that's you see the incredibly infectious smile that's on the cover, the cover photo of my wife holding up Elise. That's when the giggles and the laugh began to come, the sweetest sound in the world.
Mm. Scott Simon's memoir, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in Praise of Adoption, was published by Random House back in 2010, the year that this interview was recorded and initially broadcast. If you would like to hear this or any of the other interviews excerpted today in their entirety, we direct you to the Morning Show archives at WGTD.org, or you can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast. Look for the Morning Show with Greg Berg. I'm Gregory Berg. Thank you for listening to Morning Show Saturday. Have a good day.
Support for WGTD comes from the Racine Theater Guild, presenting Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, the Fractured Fairy Tale Musical, July 15th through the 31st. Tickets, information, and a full calendar of shows are at racinetheater.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Tuesdays at the Shell Concert Series in Panoia Park runs through August. The free public concerts take place Tuesday evenings beginning at 6